The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the final stream for tonight, and it is with Apollonian Jam. Now, Apollonian Jam was on Millennial several times in the past, but it's been 3 years since his last... Well, let me just confirm that. I think it was 2019. It's been a while since he was last on. Let's see. Yeah, it was 2020.
2020.
Right. Yeah. So welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor. It's a privilege. And I'm glad to be talking with you. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, excellent. Do you want to introduce yourself just to anyone who doesn't know of you?
Yeah. Well, a lot has changed since 2020. I've had two children. My daughter just turned three. My son
Congratulations.
Thank you. My son is 1.5. So I'm doing my part. Yeah, and so being a father, you know, comes with a lot of challenges. It's sort of made me take a step back from making videos and being as active as I used to be in the sort of social spheres around here. So, you know, my mind has been preoccupied with parenting, and so a lot of the thinking that I've been doing lately has been in relation to that. So, you know, one of the main topics that I'd like to explore tonight is the DQ, the big DQ, the Disney question. Because as a parent, you know, there's so much out there, in sort of the entertainment sphere that everybody has instant access to these days, that is just degenerate, bad influence. Disney itself has become sort of a laughing stock among conservative right-wing people about how woke they've become. And I wanted to explore the history of Disney and sort of give some evaluations on their older films and talk about which ones are based and which ones are not so based, and what's sort of what could get the stamp of approval from people like us, in terms of what's decent to show to your children. Before that, you know, I was, as the title shows, I'm a conspiracy bro. A lot of my content is, involves, digging into the great conspiracy of how our civilization has gotten to the point that it's at. And one of my main sort of methodologies in that regard and getting some explanations, getting some understanding on that front is genealogical. I like to explore the particular people, the particular events that have happened, the power shifts that have happened. And that's no different in my analysis of Disney. So we'll be looking at some specifics on how Disney really got to the point that it's at today.
That should be very interesting. I was looking at, through my meme collection for Disney memes, and I do have several. And the first one is actually one that combines Disney with the whole conspiracy thing. So here it is. and that is rather ominous. Of course, we all know that Epstein... What was the... Did you see that interview where the guy... I've forgotten the guy's name now, but he accidentally said, of course Epstein didn't kill himself.
Oh, no, I didn't see
Very
that.
Very amusing.
Yeah.
Hilarious. I can't remember who it was, but it was a big old Jewish guy, American. So anyway, that's one. And this is about the whole diversity stuff. and then trans solo, and then race swapping characters. I did have another one of that ilk, but I don't think it's broadcastable. And then finally this one, where they make everything gay. And it's astonishing how much Disney has done this kind of thing. I mean, everyone moans about Netflix, and I've got even more Netflix memes. People are churning them out, because Netflix is very famous for this. But I think Disney, I don't know, it took people a bit longer to realize that Disney was just as bad. Or maybe it took Disney a while to catch up with Netflix, because it's ostensibly kiddie-oriented. I should get rid of that. And so, I don't know. To me, Netflix sort of set the tone for all of this. But then Disney are just as bad now. But anyway, we're going to go into the history of all of that. So I think just to open it up, I'm not a parent myself, but I certainly share this concern that kids are obviously being subverted all over in every possible way. And parents looked at a brand like Disney as they think it's reassuring, it's reliable. They remember watching it as a child themselves, and their parents watched it, and their grandparents watched it as children. And so it's frightening to see how subversive it is nowadays. But anyway, let's get to the history and start from the start. So you take it away.
Yeah, well, and Disney earned that legacy. I will argue that a lot of their early stuff was wholesome. It was fully and consciously in line with the legacy of European traditional storytelling and music and art. And, you know, the first couple decades that they were producing movies, most of those movies, almost all, were consciously, they saw themselves as being heirs of this ancient European tradition. That's what I'll argue. And so the cracks began to form along the way. There are some examples in the 90s among the Disney Renaissance films that show sort of the beginnings of a trend toward ideological leftism, anti-whitism, all that kind of stuff that we're against. You get the first glimpses of that in the 90s. And today it's really just they're not producing anything of value, anything of art, period. And so that process.
I should say, just sorry to interrupt, but I should say it's just on a personal note, because we were saying before we went on air that they're no longer able to do the old style cell animation that they were famous for, because now it's all CGI, it's all digital. It's worth saying, I don't think I've ever actually said this publicly, one of possibly my very earliest memory, I'm not into Disney. It's for kids, obviously, and it's more a female thing than a male thing as you get older. So I didn't watch it throughout my childhood. But I think possibly my earliest memory was going to the cinema when I was very young, very small, and seeing The Lady and the Tramp. Because I have this memory of the camera, as it were, moving away on a rainy night, and the dog is in a kennel or something like that. And I looked, because I thought, this a few years ago, it occurred to me, I've got this memory, and it's so vivid, but I don't remember ever watching the film as a child. I remember it being at the cinema. And anyway, I found out that it was re-released in Britain in 1985.
Oh, yeah.
I would have been 2.
Yeah.
I mean, that is astonishing to me.
Deep and the impression. Reason
exactly. The reason I mention this is just to emphasize, if it's like that for me, who's not even into this stuff, I can only imagine how deeply these images and sounds and scenes burned their way into the minds and the memories of people who really loved this, who really loved Disney. It's really quite profound, and so it's all the sadder that they have turned their backs on the wholesomeness, but also on the whole technique of cell animation. That is the last time I'll intervene. Well, within reason.
intervene as much as you want. Yeah, yeah, I don't want it to be a straight lecture, but
yeah, but I don't want to take you off course again. That's the point.
I would say, you know, you said it's for children, and a lot of it is toward the feminine, sort of feminine angle. But I hope that after this, you'll change your mind a little bit on that, because as I began to rewatch these movies, especially the ones that I'll praise here in this talk, I was really impressed by how adult the themes were in some of the, like the good films. There's very adult themes. The writing is definitely not meant for children. They use all kinds of words and phrases that, the vocabulary level was definitely intended for an adult audience. The lyrics and the music also very much intended for an adult audience. There's so many things that as a child you would have definitely missed. And even as an adult, if you're not paying attention, you would miss it. The people responsible for the Disney Renaissance really tried to make movies that were family films that would appeal to the parents and the children. And nowadays it's purely just dumbed down, super childish type of stuff. But back then it was definitely art, I would say. At least the best among them were very artful and not worthy of being demeaned as just like a children's movie. You know,
I didn't mean to disparage it. Seems in my, you know, in my head. It's not something that my friends were into.
And I thought that too. Yeah, being into Disney when I was a teenager especially was lame. You know, you couldn't have been more lame than to be a Disney kid when I was growing up. And so, it was years and years since I had watched these films, and now rewatching them with my children changed my perspective on a lot of them. So, but anyway, let's begin with Walt himself, because there's a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding Walt, the people who think he was a Freemason, people who think he was Jewish, people who think, I don't know how much can we openly discuss on this platform about that.
The summary looked fine. The summary looked fine.
Okay. So Walt himself, you know, if you ask somebody who's into Disney today, you'll get a lot of people who say, oh, Walt was a misogynist, sexist, you know, he was racist, he was anti-Semitic. So you've got that narrative going. But then you've also got the apologists who try to put it into context and say, oh, he was just a man of the times and he wasn't really anti-Semitic, he wasn't really a misogynist. I'm going to kind of take a middle road here and say, in a lot of ways, he was the prototype of a boomer. He valued American freedom. He valued his own legacy. He wanted to make a name for himself. and he had a lot of traditional views at the time about things like gender relations, gender roles, about the races, racial differences. And you see that in a lot of the early movies that we'll talk about. But so I had a list of facts that could lend you to see him as based, and then a list of facts that would lend you to see him as not based. So beginning with the based, a quote from Disney is, "Women do not do any of the creative work in connection with preparing the cartoons for the screen, as that task is performed entirely by young men." And that, I think, is sort of prescient in that the current state of Disney, I think, in a lot of ways, is informed by their female leadership. And I think that is one of the many factors that has gone into stifling creativity within Disney. So he definitely had a traditional view of men versus women in the roles of his company. The second point is, of course, he has the Jewish caricature peddler in The Three Little Pigs. So the wolf turns in, like, he disguises himself as a Jewish peddler to try to get into the pig's house. There's the fact that in 1938, a month after Kristallnacht, Disney personally welcomed the famous Nazi director Leni Riefenstahl to his studios when just about every other studio was shunning her. There's also a claim that Disney attended German-American Bund meetings in the 1930s, and the German-American Bund was the American like pro-Nazi party, basically, in the 30s. So one of his Jewish animators made that claim about Disney. It's a contested claim. Number five is that Walt Disney and the auto magnate Henry Ford, who we all know, we should all know, was a big time conspiracist about the you know who's. He wrote, he basically promoted
He wrote several very controversial things.
Right. He promoted the protocols of the Elders of Zion, these sorts of things. And they were friends. They were close friends. Also, and this gets into a big moment in the history of the company. Walt believed that communist agitators were out to get him. Basically, he believed that communist agitators were the organizing leadership of the labor union movement that Disney was completely opposed to. So in the 1930s, there was a big effort to unionize in the studio, which Walt was rejecting because he wanted full creative control over what's coming out of his company, what's being produced. And this is a theme going forward too, of why the creative process worked so well under Walt's leadership. So there's a whole story of one of his lead animators, Art Babbitt, who happens to be Jewish, was the sort of main leader of this unionizing movement, and Walt fired him, and they were having a picket line, a strike line in front of the studios. Walt went through the line, and Babbitt started hurling obscenities at Disney, calling him names, mocking him. Disney got out and literally like walked up to him, ready to throw fists at Babbitt. So there was just immense personal tension going on here, and Disney believed that Babbitt and a number of others, a guy called Herbert Sorrell, David Hilberman, and William Pomerantz, to name just a few prominent names. He believed that these people were communist agitators that were attempting to basically take over and subvert his leadership of the company. And turns out all these people were Jews, by the way. And also turns out later on, it was revealed with Herbert Sorrell in particular. He later admitted to being funded by communists. Decades later, he admitted basically he was funded by communists. Hilberman studied theater and stagecraft in a communist school in Leningrad. So basically, you know, it's safe to assume that he was a communist. And William Pomerantz was also closely associated with Hilberman, the guy who studied in Leningrad, and his parents were first generation immigrants from Russia. So for Walt to be naming these figures as communist agitators, I think history has vindicated him that basically he was right. And he joined an organization called the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, which was in their mission statement, or in their like statement of principles. They said, quote, "In our special field of motion pictures, we resent the growing impression that this industry is made of and dominated by communists, radicals, and crackpots. We believe that we represent the vast majority of the people who serve this great medium of expression. But unfortunately, it has been an unorganized unorganized majority. This has been almost inevitable. The very love of freedom, the rights of the individual, make this great majority reluctant to organize. But now we must, or we shall, meanly lose the last best hope on earth." So that's very prescient to me. This was back in the in the 40s, where they're talking about, you know, the motion picture industry being dominated by communists, radicals, crackpots, you know, what we see today, and that the it's bemoaning the fact that the majority is so unorganized compared to the minority.
I'm just thinking about, yeah, the organized minority versus the shambolic, the disorganized majority. It's so cliched, you can't believe it.
Yeah.
And it works. It happens that way because the minority have an agenda, whereas the majority don't. So they don't know that they have to be organized.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think Walt was one of those people who was sort of naive to just how organized this minority was and just how far they were willing to go and how far seeing their agenda was, how much time they were willing to bide, you know, to get this done. So
I think this is something that a lot of white men in particular struggle to imagine. It wouldn't occur to them to do something that will not even bear fruit in their lifetime. You know, it might take 100 years, it might take 200 years, it might take 50 years. I mean, the transformation of society, of Western society, hasn't actually taken all that long when you think about it. So 80 years. I mean, it depends when you want to date the start of it, but yeah, from then to now, it's really not that long at all.
Yeah, well, but the foundations go back a lot farther, and he's, you know, this is very prescient, the way that they put it there. So what else did he say here? I had a quote. This is another thing that has hamstrung our people from defending against this type of subversion. Is in the House Un-American Activities Commission that happened, that was like trying to sort out the influence of communists at the time, Disney said to the investigator, he was asked, "There are presently pending two bills relative to outlawing the Communist Party. What thoughts have you had about the passing of those bills?" And Disney says, "Well, I don't know if I qualify to speak on that. I feel if the thing can be proven un-American, that it ought to be outlawed. But I think in some way it should be done without interfering with the rights of the people. I think that will be done. I have faith. Without interfering, I mean, with the good American rights that we all have now and we want to preserve." So this is another issue where, you know, we want to maintain rights and liberty, and we don't want to be fascists. We don't want to be communists. So he's very like hands off on his approach to it. And that's another thing that I think is, if we have these principles, but they don't, it gives them an advantage.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's like giving your enemy freedom of speech. Yeah. It's a nice thing to do, but he will use his freedom of speech to destroy you. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he can, he will deny you your freedom of speech. if he can get away with it.
Right.
It's a thing. And not even freedom of speech, but even the freedom to create and run an academic department dedicated to the deconstruction of your society. Something like that. I would just ban that, you know, that kind of thing. Like Viktor Orban's been doing. That just seems like suicide to let that kind of thing continue. But anyway, go on.
Precisely. I completely agree. So the communists won, basically. They won this labor dispute with Walt. Walt held out for weeks, and it ended up coming down to the federal government intervening on behalf of the labor union. The federal government under FDR at the time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had passed laws basically protecting these labor unions. And the thing is, in a lot of these labor struggles back in the 30s and 20s and during this early 20th century, a lot of them were about things like work safety, things like how many hours you're able to work in a day, protection for workers if they're injured, things like that, things that most people would agree are decent sort of goals to have in a society. But this particular dispute, somebody wrote a very long, interesting dissertation, dissertation on it called The Disney Strike of 1941 from the Animator's Perspective. And this was a college essay for this honors project out of Rhode Island College. And the author, Lisa Johnson, basically argues that really this labor strike was different from most other labor strikes because they weren't interested in protecting safety. They weren't interested in increasing wages per se, but they were interested in creative basically like the intellectual property rights of the animators versus the owner of the company. It was a struggle to sort of gain a foothold within the company to take away artistic and creative control and credit and intellectual property rights from the owner and sort of distribute it throughout the corporation. So I would say that this 1941 strike was the beginning, the first crack in the sort of shadowy elites gaining their control over the Disney Corporation. And
if you do own or run every major studio in Hollywood, and there's one that you don't control, that you don't own and run, then it would make sense to try to subvert it from within and gain control of it in that way, sort of disintegrate it almost.
Especially when it's run by somebody as charismatic, as willful, independent-minded as Walt Disney. And so even after this, he maintained basically like cultural control over Disney. He defined the culture. He was a figure that everybody looked up to, everybody admired. So they couldn't take that away from him. But this was the beginning. And this happened also right after the start of World War II. So leading up to World War II, one of the biggest markets for Disney was Europe. You know, back at that time, the developed world, the areas that were even able to show movies in theaters were basically the United States and Europe. So Europe was a huge share of the market for Disney. And they, in the 30s, were assuming larger and larger budgets for their movies. And Pinocchio happened, was being made just before the start of World War II. So World War II breaks out in Europe. And now suddenly you have this huge project, Pinocchio, that they put tons of money in. They also just built new studios. They were investing tons of money at this time. And World War II breaks out and the movie flops because half the movie theaters that it could have been showed in were not showing movies anymore because of the outbreak of the war. So Disney was in a hard financial situation at that time too. And this that essay that I just referred to about the animator strike talks about how Disney at that time owed Bank of America millions of dollars. So this is another way that sort of shadowy elites can suddenly take control over your company is through debt.
It's worth saying, I just looked up their filmography, and at that point they had released Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in 1937, and that was their first theatrical release. Yeah. And then Pinocchio in 1940, and also Fantasia in 1940, which must have been a huge project. The resources that went into that, I can't imagine. And then The Reluctant Dragon in 1941, and Dumbo at the end of 1941. So a lot of, I mean, that's not many. It just occurred to me that this is actually very early on in the Disney story, that this strike happened.
Right. And prior to that, it was mostly shorts, like the Silly Symphonies and other like short films. So the feature films were that began with Snow White. So yeah, they hit it big, and then boom, debt cripples them. The labor strike alters the way that intellectual property works within the company. And by the way, Art Babbitt, I was wanted to say about Art Babbitt before I forget, he was an intelligence agent. He worked for U.S. intelligence during World War II. So he was, I think intelligence networks and or intelligence agencies are one of the backbones of the like New World Order sort of conspiracy organizations. So to see him linked with military intelligence is very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly.
So, and by these animators were making the equivalent today of like $2,000 to $5,000 a week. They were well paid. So yeah, the whole like strike was obviously not motivated by pay.
Yeah. And but, as you say, it's interesting what it was motivated by, because as I said, you would want to take that studio over in some way, or you'd want to cripple it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it makes sense that that was what they were fighting for with that strike.
Yeah.
By the way, I looked again, and the company was going from 1926 or something onwards, and that was when they were doing the. But Snow White was the start of it being a huge company.
Yeah.
So anyway, please continue.
Yeah. So that leads into the 40s and 50s, which, like I said, I still think that Walt's. And we'll talk about how influential Walt was in the company. I still think he maintained creative control over the company just based on purely on his gravitas, you know, his force of will. But that was the beginning. And in the decades that followed, there was also the initial public offering where he went public and sold shares on the stock market, something that Disney did not want to do initially. So the fact that he was millions in debt to the Bank of America, you know, he started taking on more debts. This is how you lose control over your company. So that's the final point on the based side of Disney at this point. The not based side has some questionable facts. Disney was he personally employed many people of the Jewish faith. The list is extremely long. I'm not going to get into it. So, you know, even at that time in the early days of movie production, that tribe dominated. They were completely dominant. And so Disney was sort of an aberration. And he knew that these people had skill. They had talent. That's not deniable. So he took them on and, you know, he employed a lot of you-know-whos in high-level positions. The famous head of Disney merchandising for over a decade, named Kay Kamen, who also happened to be Jewish, quipped that the Disney company had more Jews in it than the Book of Leviticus. Walt regularly donated without any publicity, like his other charitable contributions, so this was like secret donations, to a number of Jewish charities like the Yeshiva College, the Jewish Home for the Aging, Hebrew Orphan Asylum of the city, and in 1955, the Beverly Hills chapter of B'nai B'rith, which is the oldest Jewish service organization in the world, declared Walt its Man of the Year after extensive investigation to determine if he had any anti-Semitic tendencies. So
don't you think there's a possibility that these donations to Jewish charities was, I mean, I don't know. I have no idea. This is the first time I've heard of it, but it just occurs to me that an obvious explanation for that would be it was his way of, it was hoping that this would get them off his back.
That could be a part of it, but I think the other bit of it is just naivete, which is, you know, it's hard to imagine how all the, If he noticed all the communists coming at him, why wouldn't he notice that all these communists were also of the tribe? But it was a different world back then. I think, you know, he was living in a time when white European cultural hegemony and even political hegemony seemed like a given. You know, it seemed like it's
an invincible.
Right. So, you know, the you-know-whos, they might be a little weird. You might not agree with everything they do. You might not get along with them in particular, but damn, they're good animators. So why not hire them? And, you know, we know that they're powerful in Hollywood. Why not, you know, throw a few shekels their way and sort of like grease the wheels working in that industry? You know, it's, I think he would have sort of had that naive perspective. Yeah.
But it's interesting that it says here, in 1955, the Beverly Hills chapter of the B'nai B'rith declared Walt its Man of the Year after extensive investigation to determine if he had any anti-Semitic tendencies. So that's what I mean about, did he make these charitable donations because he knew, even by then, even by 55, that they were calling him an anti-Semite.
Right.
So,
like the ADL of the time. That kind of a thing. Yeah. And a lot of the anti-Semitic accusations actually came from the Jews who he was labeling communist agitators. So that was their, you know, that was their shield. That was
one of their weapons.
Right.
Call him an anti-Semite and then he'll have to acquiesce. Yeah.
Yep. So I say, however, you know, despite all of that, the golden age of Disney, the golden age is considered the period in which Walt was actually the creative director of the company, under Walt's leadership, despite even some successful attempts to take power away from him, via the labor union, and the going public with the company and the debt that he was in, the company still saw a flourishing of artful movies that consciously paid homage to European traditions. I think Disney saw himself as heir to our ancient cultural legacy and wished to uphold and extend the legacy rather than destroy or upend it, which is what they're doing today. So that kind of ends a lot of the history. Now I want to get into particular examples of how his art upheld certain European traditions. The first is Snow White, which comes from a Brothers Grimm fairy tale. A lot of these come from traditional European folklore and fairy tales. The dwarves, you know, as a concept, go back to ancient Germanic traditions, as early as the Eddas. Magic mirrors date back to ancient Greece and has a long tradition in European magical traditions. True Love's Kiss dates back to Shakespeare, Perrault and beyond, and a lot of these early movies too were basically pro-natalist and pro traditional chivalric concepts of love and romance. You know, they and this is something one of the in the current remake of Snow White, I don't know if you've seen the actress that they've cast as Snow White and how she talks about, oh, the new Snow White, she's going to be a girl boss. She doesn't need love. She just needs power and leadership and getting ahead. So, you know, at that time, promoting things like romantic love and chivalry and, you know, doing it all within the themes and space of these European traditional motifs, I think is a good thing. I think that, you know, it's something that I want my daughter, I want my son to view love and marriage as this romantic and legendary traditional thing. So that's Snow White. The Silly Symphonies. These are underappreciated in the Disney filmography. A lot of these early Silly Symphonies refer back to ancient classical myths. Like one is called the Goddess of Spring, which is literally just the story of Persephone and Hades. So this is like bringing into the 20th century the story of ancient Greek myths for children to consume. Also common European folk tales such as Little Red Riding Hood, Three Little Pigs, Jack and the Beanstalk, the Four Musicians of Bremen, Puss in Boots, Old King Cole, Hansel and Gretel, etc. All of these were made into silly symphonies. And it's just, you know, in a lot of ways they're dumbed down. In a lot of ways they're defanged, because a lot of the old European folk tales actually have pretty terrible endings. But it still grounds a child when they're watching it into this ancient tradition and heritage. And it gives them, like you were saying earlier, this impression that stays with you for a lifetime. It becomes part of your cultural vocabulary. And there aren't many other ways that that's being done today. You know, I certainly would have never, as a child, read like Ovid's Metamorphoses or something like that to learn the story of Persephone and Hades, but I would watch a silly symphony. So that's a good thing. Also, most of them contain direct renditions of classical European music. So he's, you know, putting in classical music in all of these, getting you sort of versed in that high culture of Europe. And most contain good moral lessons. A lot of the moral lessons centered around themes of perseverance, of hard work, of preparedness, humility, warnings against vanity, warnings against short-sightedness, caution against strangers. And of course, the idea that goodness will be rewarded, which is, you know, that you think about fiction, fantasy these days with like the likes of George R. R. Martin, the idea that goodness will be rewarded is scorned and mocked and ridiculed and inverted. So I think these are good themes for children to learn. Fantasia, the next movie in the list, evokes all kinds of European traditional imagery, including the natural beauty of the European countryside, classical Greco-Roman mythological settings, monks and cathedrals. It pays homage to every facet of traditional European culture and imagery. It's also filled with beautiful orchestral scores by the likes of Bach, Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, and more. And the most famous section of the movie, which I didn't even know this until I started researching it, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, is actually based on a poem by Goethe. So, like I said earlier, you know, a lot of the stuff in these movies are not going to be caught by children when they first watch it, but it leaves this deep impression in them so that later in life, when they learn things like, oh, The Sorcerer's Apprentice is based on a poem by Goethe, maybe I'll read Goethe, you know, maybe I'll get into listening to more Bach and Beethoven because I have these good impressions in my soul that were left at such an early age. I think that's incredibly important. Pinocchio is based on a 19th century story written by the Italian Carlo Collodi, which itself was rooted in many traditional Italian fairy tales. The one early film that I'm not a huge fan of is Bambi. It kind of changes the pattern here. Bambi was based on a story originally written by an Austrian Jew named Felix Salten. And according to Wikipedia, the novel traces the life of Bambi, a male deer, from his birth to childhood, the loss of his mother, the finding of a mate, the lessons that he learns from his father, and the experience that he gains about the dangers posed by human hunters in the forest. And guess who the human hunters are meant to be? They're meant to be the Europeans, because it says in its most complete translation, it's seen as a parable of the dangers and persecution of the Jews in Europe. So it's because the Jews are these poor little doe deers that ain't never hurt nobody, and us Europeans are the mean, intolerant hunters that just want to take them down. So that's the one that doesn't fit the pattern. Next, Cinderella, based on a fairy tale first recorded by Charles Perrault in the 1600s. It tells, you know, one of the morals is good equals beautiful, bad equals ugly, which is something that I think has a lot more truth to it than most people will admit.
Yes. It also, I agree. Is that, yeah, sorry, go on.
It also has the theme of goodness will be rewarded. You persevere, you keep your head down, you keep doing the right thing, and your goodness will be rewarded. That is something that I think when you're looking at a culture that believes something like that, it shows such optimism. It shows such strength. It shows such a level of discipline and moral uprightness that today we are sorely lacking. You know, if for that message to hit and to feel believable to people tells a lot about your culture in general. You know, that goodness will be rewarded. And its core thematic song, which in my opinion is one of the best Disney songs, A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. It's actually based on a melody from Franz Liszt's Transcendental Etude number 9. So another way that, you know, classical European music went into influencing early Disney. Then we have Alice in Wonderland, not based on ancient European folklore or anything, but it is based on Lewis Carroll's novel written in the 1800s. And I think a lot of the themes surround retaining good European common sense in an increasingly nonsensical modern world. So not a bad film. It's not my favorite, but it's not a bad film. Peter Pan, also a great film. Based on the Scottish, he's a Scottish playwright, James Barry, in 1904. It contains many classical European adventure fiction motifs, like pirates, mermaids, fairies, Indians. And the Indians are portrayed in this hilariously caricatured way. It's very funny. And it, you know, that movie gets a hard disclaimer at the start when you try to watch it on Disney Plus that says this film shows outdated racist caricatures, but it's just so funny. It's worth watching just for that. And some of the moral lessons in that are things like valuing imagination and wonderment, the importance of responsibility, the dangers of never growing up, the joy of friendship and the power of family. These are the sorts of moral themes that are throughout Peter Pan. And, you know, we'll compare this to some of the themes in the Disney Renaissance, where I think it sort of begins to take an even worse turn. But these are the old themes of most Disney movies. You know, they're just good, wholesome, common sense moral themes. Sleeping Beauty, which I think is the most visually stunning, probably the best. My background is art by Eyvind Erl, who was the artist that created the style for Sleeping Beauty. It's kind of this art deco, medieval gothic tapestry style. It's really beautiful. I never actually watched the film until I started preparing for this stream. And I was awestruck by it. Really looks like a moving medieval tapestry. It's really unique. Other Disney movies don't have this style at all. Beautifully done, and you know, set in a European kingdom, and it's just a beautiful visually. It's beautiful to watch. It traces itself back to, once again, Charles Perrault, who was one of these early figures that recorded a lot of folklore and folk legends in the 1600s. But this particular story itself is traceable back even farther to the 1300s, to a medieval romance called Perceforest, which was this legendary history of Great Britain. And a lot of the core themes, even in that, can be traced back to ancient Greece. So, you know, these stories are rooted deeply into our European storytelling traditions. Perceforest itself, by the way, is a fascinating read. I'm amazed that even by the 1300s, the British still believed that they were descendants of Trojans. That's kind of just a strange aside. I learned also that even up until the early 1900s, Welsh schools were teaching children the history of, like, Geoffrey of Monmouth or the Perceforest legends, that Britain was originally settled and named after Brutus the Trojan. I find that fascinating. That's probably Survive the Jive would be a good guy to talk to about those kinds of legends, but that's total tangent. And the music in Sleeping Beauty is based on Tchaikovsky, the Sleeping Beauty Ballad. So very much in the legacy of classical music traditions. Next, I have 101 Dalmatians. I didn't have much to say about that. That was based on a recent book. The Sword in the Stone, based on Arthurian legend. So once again, ancient European tradition. The Jungle Book was based on Rudyard Kipling's book of the same name. And The Jungle Book is widely criticized today by liberals because the themes include the importance of sticking to your own kind, the importance of growing up and assuming a mature role in life, the orangutans in The Jungle Book are obviously like stand-ins for blacks. They play jazz music. They talk like black people. So, you know, the liberals, you know, hate The Jungle Book because of those kinds of implicit racist perspectives. So that's all I got for like classic Disney. There's obviously a lot more old classic Disney that can be discussed, but those are the ones that I think defined the legacy. And those are the ones that I think, you know, I've done enough to establish how the early works of Disney were rooted in older traditional European storytelling and art and music. So all of those get the germ stamp of approval for showing your children.
So out of all of those, just to summarize, and you've made a great study here, it's a very good overview. Out of all of those, what would you say is subversive, if anything at all?
Well, out of those, I really didn't, besides Bambi, but even that one is a subtext that is really deep. You know, you'd have to be really kind of stretching to get that interpretation out of it. A child is never going to watch Bambi and think, wow, this is the plight of the European Jews.
Exactly. Even if that is the original subtext, I don't think it would translate to, right. But by the time it arrives in the child's mind, I just don't see how it would have any subversive effect.
Right. So honestly, all in all, these early films and the silly cinema.
I think we might have lost his connection. Oh, dear. I don't know what's happened here. I'll remove him and see. All right, here he is. Are you back? No? This is rather strange. Hold on a second. I'll see what's going on. I think he's messaged me. Oh my God, he says, I don't believe it. My power went out. Just came back on. Right. So I guess he'll be back any second. I'm actually, it's a shame because I'm enjoying this and I'm sure the disruption will be minimal. So just stick around and Jerm will be back with us. I'll switch my camera off as well in the meantime. Please just relax, maybe make a cup of tea or something like that. Thank you. Hello, welcome back.
I cannot believe the power went out. The power is out on my entire block. So I'm standing in my backyard and it's completely, there's no light anywhere.
Oh my God.
So I'm on my phone now.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, how much power do you have in your phone?
21%.
Right. Okay. What we could do is reschedule it for another time, or we could just end it here and say that it's a lovely overview of early Disney. It's up to you.
Well, I mean, if you have, there was a whole, how long had we gone for at that point, by the way?
55 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I had about another 30 minutes or 45 minutes of material that I wanted to cover.
Yeah, I know. We are live, I should say.
Okay.
So that you know.
I cannot believe this.
Yeah. See, if you've only got 20% on the phone, then otherwise I could talk you through the plan that you gave me, and you could just do it from memory.
I mean, we could just rush through and finish the rest then, because.
Okay. Well, let's do it then.
I'd rather not.
Sure. Well, one thing you should do is stop the camera, because that'll save battery power on your phone.
True. There.
Good. Excellent. Okay. So here we are. We're back again. So the next thing was the Disney Renaissance in the 90s.
Right. So, after this early, like, classic golden age of Disney,
the death of Walt and the Disney Dark Age, 66 to 89. Take it away.
Right. So when Walt died, basically Disney was in disarray. Walt was such an instrumental force in leading that company. This is like one of the main things I wanted to talk about in the decline, which is how corporate culture today has just completely ruined the creative vision of the company. There is no true creative vision left in Disney. And
just before you go on, some people are suggesting you could plug your phone into your car or into a power bank or into a laptop in order to get power.
Yeah, if I get down below 10%, maybe I'll go to my car.
Okay.
So there's some quotes that I had there.
Oh, what's happened now? Have you muted?
Hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Yeah.
Oh, I can't.
I'll get the quotes.
Could you read the quotes that people wrote about Disney's leadership?
So you've said, the loss of Walt Disney also marked a shift in the corporate culture of the company. He had had a unique ability to inspire and guide his team. After his death, the corporate structure changed, and some argue a more bureaucratic and risk-averse culture emerged. So Art Babbitt said, Walt Disney didn't run a democracy. He ran a benevolent dictatorship. There was no backtalk. There was no arguing. There was no anything. He was the king, and you were there to serve him. That's Art Babbitt.
And Art says that in, like, a disparaging tone. You know, he says that in he was too authoritarian. He was too controlling. You know, he wanted to control everything. And people love to say that about great leaders without realizing that, you know, during the time when Walt did have that total control, great things were being done. And without that central defining leadership, you're basically, you know, out at sea without a captain. You know, I think any creative artistic endeavor has to be unified. It has to have a unified vision, and that can only come from somebody who sees the whole thing from a bird's eye perspective and knows what a good product will look like. And as we get into modern Disney, it becomes clear that unifying dictatorship, benevolent dictatorship, has devolved into sort of a democracy, so to speak, creative democracy, which stifles creativity. It becomes like a boardroom committee where nobody has full ownership over the product. And therefore, you know, everybody feels like they're special and important, but also everybody else is special and important. So nobody like fully commits to their ideas. They're always reserved. They're always looking for and trying to make sure they can get a consensus. And that is one of the main things that has destroyed Disney in the past couple decades.
That's interesting. That's a really interesting summary there of what happens when a decisive leader is lost and everyone's at sea, and but everyone's equal as well because no one's the leader. So, yeah, you end up with bland consensus seeking. That's very good. Okay, animator Frank Thomas, one of Disney's nine old men, spoke about Disney's approach to storytelling and creativity. He demanded a lot. He demanded perfection, but he was always very supportive. He was a great storyteller himself. He'd get up in front of the whole group and act out a whole scene. You had a good role model. You know, honestly, he just sounds fantastic. He sounds like a great leader, and it would be fun. It would be rewarding to serve this guy.
Yeah, and nobody's willing to do that kind of like to serve in that way anymore. You know, everybody wants to be the leader, but also everybody wants to, you know, treat everybody else like they're special and have important ideas. It's changed from a creative leader that is directing a crew to a collaboration among equals. And that has totally stifled. It's become passive aggressive. It's become, you know, all the frustrations get buried underground. And what we see too in the Disney Renaissance is new charismatic figures emerge, like Howard Ashman, who, yeah, he was gay, he was Jewish, he died of AIDS, but he was acknowledged by a lot of the people who worked with him as a second Walt. And I have a quote about that too that comes up. I think he was acknowledged as a second Walt because he assumed that position of leadership where he knew what made a good movie, he knew what made good music, and he was not afraid to assert himself and to also just explain how that came about. So in the years between Walt and the early 90s Disney Renaissance, we have this dearth of leadership. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, you have the emergence of this new, you know, class of leadership in Disney, where they were in hard straits at that time. The animation department was basically like moved out of the main animating studio and put into these trailers in a nearby sort of gravel park. And so I think desperation, where they were willing to just say, like, we'll try anything, is what created this, like, vacuum where strong personalities could fill the void again. So that's how it transitions from, you know, they almost even shut down the animating studio in the 80s to suddenly this rebirth. And the new culture that emerged in the 90s for that brief period was a second coming of this culture of strong leadership, strong opinions, open criticism of people, fighting for your ideas, heavy competition between the animators. Everybody's able to say what's on their mind. Everybody's able to criticize everybody else as long as you have good arguments. And that image you just showed is most of the leadership that ended up becoming.
Yeah, I realized I should have put that up. It should be said, this is them in 1975. These are the people who later became in charge of it and in the 90s. So this is them when they're young, but 15 years later, they led the Renaissance. Jam?
Oh, sorry, you cut out for a second.
Yeah, yeah. 15 so, years later, these people led the Renaissance.
Right. And you, when you look at them, notice also, it's almost all white men. And this is something that if you want a creative endeavor, I believe, has to come from unity. That's the big theme that I would push. And you can't have unity if the people aren't similar. You know, they work together so well because they're all so similar. And it's the current batch of Disney animators and directors and stuff is very diverse, which I think adds to the creative bankruptcy that Disney is currently.
Because I'm, you know, you can see with this group, I've no doubt that they had disagreements, rivalries even, but you can imagine that they understood each other, that they were able to understand each other. In a diverse group, it simply cannot be like that. You will not understand each other. So I guess you'll just have to defer to either being very polite and avoiding any conflict, or you'll have to defer to management to sort out a conflict. But also the average, and you'll be seeking an average
consensus
land.
Go ahead.
No, go on. You go.
I think I've just been lagging with my phone, sorry. That's why I'm talking over you now. But that level of creative unity and overall vision is so hard to achieve when you have all these competing diverse groups within the company that you never feel like you could speak for everybody. So you can't approach it like Howard Ashman did, where Howard Ashman, you know, he would come in and he would tell the actors, the voice actors, this is exactly how I want you to do it, and here's why. Or this is exactly how I want you to sing it, and here's why. Ashman would come in and give lectures and tell them, like, this is what a song needs to do in the film, and these are the reasons why, and this is how it works. So he had this clear overview, this creative vision of what makes a movie a good musical movie, what makes particular voice acting good acting, and then he would be able to explain why. And, you know, he was very upfront and direct about that. Whereas today, nobody really has that overall vision. I was watching, this is skipping ahead a little bit, but if you watch, it's a docuseries called The Making of Frozen 2, and something as simple as, you know, in Frozen 2, I don't know if you've ever seen it, one of the main plot points is that Elsa hears this singing voice at the start of the movie, and this singing voice calls her on this adventure. And they didn't know what the singing voice was going to turn out to be in the end until like 2 months before the deadline for the movie to finish was. So there's nobody there. Nobody's in the boardroom with this clear creative vision of what the full product is going to end up as. It's like, I've likened it to AI generation, where somebody comes in with a vague prompt, and the prompt is then inputted into the human computer machine, and each compartmentalized part of the computer machine spits out iterations, and then the directors and the creative directors and the people in charge will pick and choose from these iterations and sort of build a movie in this compartmentalized algorithmic way, rather than someone like Ashman or these other guys who were involved in the 90s Renaissance, who would storyboard almost the entire movie on their own, or they would create all the songs for the movie on their own, because they had this clear vision of what a good movie would look like. You know, you need that as an artist. Art needs that unity of style and vision. And the way that they're making movies today is so it's inhuman almost, you know, it's been corporatized and HR department
HR departmentized. I don't know what verb to give that. To the point where it's not even like human anymore. It's bizarrely compartmentalized and yeah.
I remember seeing one of these, I don't know what they call it, an all hands meeting. I think it was either at Disney or at Star Wars, which I guess is the same thing now. It was about 5 years ago. And it was a bunch of young, like, you know, millennials getting together to brainstorm the new film. And this person was standing at the whiteboard and she said, so what do we want? And then, and the first person, someone put up their hand, and the first suggestion was diversity. And so she, yeah, we want diversity. And she wrote it down on the whiteboard. And I thought, well, what else can you safely say in that room?
Right.
You know, what else are they all going to agree on? Nothing.
Exactly.
It's just this utter blandness and political doctrine that they all have to follow.
Right. Yeah. It's really how a lot of things are going these days. It's like corporate culture in general has gone that way. And, you know, I see it in just like pervading the culture in general, where people these days have a really hard time being assertive about their vision of something and telling somebody else that they're wrong. You know, it's always couched in, I wonder if you could see it this other way, or what if we tried this other thing? Your idea is good, but how would it turn out if we tried this other thing? You know, it's always this passive aggressive, non-committal, wishy-washy type of approach, because I think people lack the sense that we're part of a unified culture that has these like set in stone, or at least like generally agreed on rules, values, ideals, techniques, things of that nature. And if you lack that unity of culture, then there's nothing that you can refer to beyond yourself and say, this is why it has to be that way, that will appeal to people, that will actually get across to them.
Do you want me to read out your notes here from the final section?
You
said, watching Frozen, there is no creative vision, no strong leading personality to make everything cohere and to unify the culture and direction of the studio. Frozen 2, for example, didn't even have a final ending written. You've said that. Deadlines, money-making, and ideological conformity seem to be the main concerns today. Not surprising, considering that Disney is owned by BlackRock, Vanguard, and other arms of international finance. Instead of actually directing and leading, the people in leading roles instead focus on collaboration, which ultimately results in creative paralysis. Nobody wants to offend anyone or to be seen as stepping on toes or dominating the process. And this neurotic desire for consensus results in nobody being able to follow their instincts freely. The whole studio feels like the HR department achieved total victory. All criticism is indirect, direction is weak and wishy-washy. And then the AI analogy.
Mm.
Leftist ideology is in full dominance in Disney as well, and leftism is divorced from reality, so everyone must constantly be looking over their shoulder and second-guessing themselves to ensure ideological conformity, also stifling creativity. Diversity itself contributes to the internal tensions and lack of unity that subverts passion and creativity. That's a really effective summary, and I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, it's the whole ideological bent to it too. Is that's something I've talked about in the past of why leftists can't make great art. You know, when you can't just follow your instincts, when you actually ideologically have to oppose and constantly check and control your instincts, when your instincts are labeled bad, that it's creative paralysis. There, creativity has to come from instinct. It has to be this free-flowing, free-form thing that comes from the heart, that comes from your passion. And when you have to constantly like filter your passions through this sieve of ideological conformity, you know, you end up with bullshit. You end up with like not a good product. But they keep pushing it because the important thing is pushing the ideology and making money. And somehow these movies were making big money in the past few years. So they just keep doing what they're doing. Yeah. So, yeah, and the final point there too about BlackRock, Vanguard, etc. This we're in the final stages of like at this point, Disney has nothing to do with Disney anymore. Disney is basically the entertainment wing of BlackRock or Vanguard or these other international finance companies that, you know, it's no longer a Disney company. And so, you know, within 100 years, it went from being family owned by Walt, controlled by Walt, to slipping into the net of the international financial empire and just becoming one more. And Disney owns so many different IPs now and brands. And that's kind of how they've shifted. Instead of making good quality artwork, now they're just part of the global international finance, you know, they're the entertainment wing of international finance at this point. So, that I think, unless I'm forgetting something in particular about the notes that I had there, that's pretty much the end of the history.
We skipped over the 90s Renaissance where you've given each one of them a rating, each of the films, which is quite interesting.
We can finish with that then.
Yeah, well, The Little Mermaid, 8 out of 10. Do you want me to read what you've said?
Yeah, sure.
Story about a strong and authoritative father, portrayed in a good and sympathetic light, who learns to cope with his daughter growing up, getting married, and leaving the house. Hilariously, modern leftoids try to spin Ariel into a trans icon. Are you there?
You cut out as you said. Hilariously modern leftoids
try to spin Ariel into a trans icon.
Oh yeah, that is hilarious. That's as a father watching that movie, you know, from my perspective, the real main character is the father. You know, he and the way he's treated too. He's authoritarian. He's strong. He's, you know, kind of in some ways brash. But he's treated sympathetically, and he never loses his dignity. He never loses his authority, even when Ariel at the end, you know, when they defeat the evil queen and Ariel is in love with the human man. She only becomes a woman. She only gets transformed from a mermaid into a woman with her father's blessing. And the whole point of it isn't for her to run off and become a girl boss. It isn't for her to, you know, transform her entire life. The whole point of it is her leaving the home and getting married. It's for the woman is transferred from the authority of her father to the authority of her husband. And that's a very traditional motif. You know, it's a very traditional theme. And it's done with the blessing of the father. He's kind of, in some ways, made light of with his authoritarianism. But at the end, his authority is still respected by both Ariel and the man that she's marrying. So, surprisingly traditional themes in The Little Mermaid, to be honest. As a father, when I watched it, I was impressed.
All right. And then Beauty and the Beast is a marked downturn here, 4 out of 10. And you describe it as basically a Jewish power fantasy where Nietzschean slave morals triumph over master morals. The only saving grace is the music and Gaston.
Yeah. There's a guy called John Doyle on YouTube who has a pretty popular sort of like alt conservative platform, you know, kind of an edgier Steven Crowder or something like that, you know, and he has a video saying Beauty and the Beast is implicitly right wing, where he kind of gets into a few of these ideas of like Gaston, he's the main villain. And Gaston is this representative of like Nietzschean master morality. He's just pure strength. He's pure domination. He's pure just hunting and skill and wanting to get the girl because she's beautiful. And a lot of these just like simple sort of like knightly aristocratic Nietzschean values are embodied by Gaston. Whereas Belle is sort of Jew coded. You know, she's bookish. Her father is an inventor who's trying to come up with labor-saving devices that would ruin the peasant economy. All these kinds of like little details where she's Jew-coded. And then the Beast is the master morality, the knightly aristocrat in decline, in his degenerative phase. And she, Belle, sort of like, gets him to transform from the blonde beast, the lion, or, you know, the Nietzschean master, into this like domesticated sort of simp that just like completely gives up his power and majesty for a woman. So there's a bit of tongue-in-cheek nature to this kind of analysis, but I think fundamentally it is like a feminist and sort of like anti knightly aristocratic movie.
Right, you're roboting. So, okay, are you there, John?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. Yes. Okay. And then we go on to Aladdin. And you say 8 out of 10 provides a distinctly Eurocentric view of exotic cultures like Arabia that has precedents going back centuries, not concerned with accuracy or anything trivial like that, and plays up the exoticism. Story of a man's will to power, loyalty to his friends, and it even hints at dangers of a weak ruler. However, in some ways it is subversive. So, Aladdin.
Yeah, Aladdin, you know, it's about a peasant upstart that wants to marry into royalty. So in some ways that's like, you know, transcending class boundaries, transcending, the typical view of this like street urchin thief who has a heart of gold type of subversion that is common in Hollywood, you know, the prostitute with the heart of gold or the thief with the heart of gold type of subversion. But, you know, Robin Williams almost single-handedly makes that movie great. And, it also follows traditional themes of like romantic love and having marriage portrayed as living happily ever after. And so there's good things to it too. And, you know, the Orientalism that is present in that movie, does have like a long precedent in European culture of using exotic locales and exotic cultures as just sort of like interesting settings for a story. Aladdin is derided by the modern liberals for not being culturally accurate or for depicting the Arabs in a racist way or whatever. But I think it's a distinctly European pastime to look at exotic cultures purely from our perspective and to not really care about accuracy or cultural sensitivity or anything like that, but to just, you know, portray them from our perspective, purely from our perspective. So,
yeah. But what's now called Eurocentrism, of course.
Right.
You've used that adjective. And then The Lion King, and you've given that 10 out of 10 and said it's the best of the Disney Renaissance. tells a Shakespearean story of a young prince who is psyoped and demoralized, becomes a degenerate doomer, and then is re-inspired by beauty and the gaze of his forebears to become who he is meant to be and reclaim his duty, responsibility, and power. The villain brings immigrants to the kingdom and ruins everything. The king and the land are one. Great music, too.
Yeah, that the king and the land are one is a line from Excalibur. Have you ever seen that one? That's the 80s?
No, I actually haven't seen Excalibur. I know of it, John Boorman, but I know I've never seen it, no.
Hello?
Oh, dear.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Just keep talking.
Hello?
Oh, dear, I think we've lost the connection.
Hello?
I'm here, Jarm.
Can you hear me?
Yep. I can hear you.
I'm sorry about this, man. I don't know what's going on.
All right.
Yeah, so the King and the Land Are One, that came from Excalibur. You know, the movie, a lot of people on the dissonant right like the movie Excalibur.
Yes.
Very, you know, it's that's also another traditional European motif of the King and the Land Are One. In The Lion King, when Scar, the usurper, is king, the whole land suffers. There's a famine, there's a drought, and with the rise of Simba, when he finally like becomes who he is, who he's meant to be, and takes back the throne, the land is also restored. And yeah, that about the immigrants is kind of also tongue-in-cheek, but it is true that like Scar invites in all the hyenas, and the hyenas end up dominating the lions in their own kingdom. So there's a lot, definitely certain themes in that movie that we can spin to our favor to represent traditional right wing and conservative values that, you know, I think makes it a really good movie. And it's a lot of people liken it to Shakespeare's Hamlet. You know, there's just the idea of an aristocratic soul that must become who he's meant to be. I like it a lot. It's my favorite of the Disney Renaissance.
Mm. Do you want to talk about the other five that you've listed here? Or do you want to, what do you want to do?
How about just finish? Yeah. Just quickly read through the last ones. I think Hercules is the other one that I really liked in the list.
Yes. Hercules 9.5 out of 10. Almost tied with The Lion King. The story honestly isn't the greatest. The ending is kind of lame, but the throwback to Greek myth is fantastic. The main girl starts off acting like she'll be another sassy girl boss, but as the story goes on, we learn that this is a defense mechanism she built up after getting her heart broken, and all it takes is a strong man to make her swoon again. Funny note, Hercules' trainer and archenemy are both of us coded in a certain way. Only thing keeping this from the perfect score is the gospel music gets a little old. Well, there we go.
Yeah, and then, the gospel. They chose gospel because it's like related to God or whatever, and it's about gods.
All right. Okay,
so they went with a gospel music theme. But yeah, the whole Greco-Roman thing is fantastic. The hero is treated unironically, without, you know, he's treated in a sincere way. It's a good movie. I like it. And the woman too, you know, you start out with this like girl boss, which previously, I think, the movie above that one in the notes is Hunchback of Notre Dame, where yes, the main woman is like hardcore girl boss. It's sort of begins with that appearance, and then you learn, oh really, this is just a defense mechanism, and Hercules is a strong man that can get past it, and it's sort of the original like I can fix her meme.
Yeah. Well, to go through the scores here, you've given Pocahontas 1 out of 10 and called it the worst of the Renaissance era. Hunchback of Notre Dame 3 out of 10, Mulan 4 out of 10, and Tarzan 6 out of 10. So it's Hercules and the Lion King that you really love there.
Yes.
And then we get to the contemporary era, which is just a complete shit show. And then at the very end of your notes, you've got this quote from Disney. Don't forget this. It's the law of the universe that the strong shall survive and the weak must fall by the way. And I don't give a damn what idealistic plan is cooked up. Nothing can change that.
Yeah.
There we go.
Nietzschean Disney.
Yeah. It's surprisingly Nietzschean, actually. I would have expected him to be more warm-hearted, I guess. But anyway, well, I'm sorry about the power cut. It's a shame, but I don't think it ruined this stream. I think this was still a very good stream indeed. And thank you for all the preparation work that you put into it. If you're disappointed by how this went, I mean, you could always redo it yourself on your own channel and just see this as a fun dress rehearsal for that. So I don't think you should see this as a waste or a failure. It really wasn't. Oh, damn.
No, we've cut out again. But yeah, thank you very much. I think I will redo this as a stream on my own. I really appreciate the chance to come on here. I appreciate it. And to all who are listening, I'll probably put out a Substack article on this too, just get really into all the details and whatnot. And yeah, so thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think you should. You've obviously put a lot of work into this. So, you know, get as much out of that as you can, I would say. Because you don't want to waste it. There are a few super chats. Dino says, I remember 54 years ago, 6:30 p.m. on a Sunday evening, bathed and in pajamas listening to When You Wish Upon a Star. They have destroyed another beautiful white creation. That's I don't know what to say. It's just very sad. Yeah. Dharma Initiate says, what do you think about conspiracies surrounding The Wizard of Oz? Is there a hidden meaning to that film? Did a midget really hang himself on set? I never heard about that. The Wizard of Oz.
I have heard about that, and I've heard that it was like an allegory for the monetary system. You know, the yellow brick road is like supposed to represent like a gold standard for the monetary system or something like that. It's very allegorical. I haven't really looked too far into it, though.
Right. Okay. And then there's a message from Charlemagne. Great topic and guest. It's important for Americans to understand film and film history, since it is our essential art form.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I think somebody on Twitter the other day said something about like film being this new form of art, and so how can we have masterpieces of film when it's just so new? And I think, you know, film is, it's building on ancient traditions of visual art, of music, of storytelling. You know, there's nothing really that new about film. It's built on a very old foundation, and I agree that film is like the essential European art form that I wish we had more people out there with the funding and the will and the creative prowess to execute good movies from our perspective. That's something I'd love to see.
Yeah. There are some messages here. Pox Populi says, hail Apollonian Germ. Thanks for your work on subjects that others might wave away or be too afraid to broach. Your stream on the House of Windsor after the Queen died comes to mind as an example. There you go.
Thank you.
Unknown Californian said, I'm excited to see Mike on your show. I really enjoy his content, especially when he drives around sharing his thoughts. Mike would be fun to go on a road trip with. My favorite video of his is about G.R.R. Martin, a true classic.
Thank you.
And he also says, what about J.R.R. Tolkien throwing shade at Walt's take on European mythology? He was not a fan of Disney's handling of European mythology.
Yeah, well, Tolkien was a very, like, a purist, and he approached it all from the like his background in philology and you know, he was definitely a unique, I don't think he wanted to write for the masses. I don't think he wanted to write as an entertainer. So yeah, they had different perspectives, but I appreciate Tolkien and I appreciate Walt. So I don't see how they're mutually incompatible, to be honest.
Yeah. And then he also says, don't forget corporate raiders, Saul Steinberg, Irwin Jacobs, and Ivan Boesky, who attempted a hostile takeover of Disney. That's a whole thing there.
Hmm.
And then finally, Black Pigeon Pilled, how did AG encounter the Thomas Baden Reese's content? Your streams together are gold, and I appreciate your analysis of Sabbatean Frankism. Thanks, MW and AG. Good Yule to you both. Well, thank you very much, Black Pigeon Pilled.
Yeah, you know, I can't even remember how I first came across TBR. He's one of, to me, the most entertaining and interesting characters in our sort of spheres. I love his brand of comedy. I love how polemical he can be. You know, to me, polemics are so important, and it's even how I interact with my family. You know, my family and I get into these harsh, heated arguments. We're very polemical toward each other when we debate, but then at the end of the day, we know we're still family. We know that, you know, we basically agree on certain essentials. And that's, you know, when I criticize people like Keith Woods, for example, I do it from that spirit where I want polemical, I want polemics, I want rivalry, I want like serious, harsh debate. But at the end of the day, I would still view somebody like Keith Woods, who I've been critical of, as part of my extended European family. And, you know, after all that debate, I would still sit down and have a beer with the guy. So that's the kind of spirit that I wish more people had, where I think too many people are just like, either they block or completely ignore critics, or they take it very seriously and it ruins the relationship. It ruins any kind of collaborative spirit in the future. And, you know, like Disney itself, you know, in the times when they were the most direct with their criticism, when they were the harshest toward each other, when they were competing and polemical toward each other, those are the times when real great things happened. And if we have a culture of like, oh, I can't criticize this person because he's like an authority figure, or I can't say this because, oh, people will get mad at me or whatever. That's so stifling. I don't like that.
I think there should always, I mean, and I want to emphasize, I've never said to Thomas that he can't disagree with anyone. Of course, I mean, I disagree with half of the people that he criticizes. I've disagreed with them publicly. The difference is in how you go about it. Because if it gets personal, people just are going to get offended and pissed off. But that's a whole thing. And I do accept what you're saying there about the cut and thrust of sometimes you need to fall out, and sometimes that is actually a sign of a deep respect for each other.
I honestly think that criticism is a sign of respect. It is a sign of respect to criticize. To say what you've said is worth thinking about and criticizing is a sign of respect.
Mm. All right. That's a whole area. Let's not get into it now. Apollonian Jam, it didn't go as we intended, but I don't think you should see this as a failure. I think a lot of people enjoyed it. I think a lot of people will enjoy it when they watch it on replay. If nothing else, at the very least, it was a good dress rehearsal, right? So yeah, please don't be dispirited. I think it went very well. Apart from the technical failure, it went very well.
Well, what I'm dispirited about right now is we still don't have power, and it's going to start getting cold in here without the fucking furnace. So let's see what happens tonight.
Well, at least you're wearing that nice that sweater. Nice, warm. the Christmas sweater. I meant to comment on that at the start. But I do wish you luck. And yeah, well, it's winter. I'm sorry. I wish I could wave a magic wand. But yeah, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I will be back tomorrow night with Monoculture FM, The Wessex Nomad, Maven Politic, and The Distributist. So that's going to be another fine mix. All right. In the meantime, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available at the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. All aboard. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.